I think that our intentions are something like this. We would hope to be able to share with you some, maybe some insights, and then our talking together over the next several sessions to discover some new depths, some new understanding, a new awareness in terms of the depths and the reality of racism. Would be also our intent to share some practical tools and some approaches that you can use in your own local situation, in your congregation, in your communities, or whatever. But then finally, I think our fundamental concern, whether we agree with one another or not in our analyses and our illustrations, our fundamental concern really is to give to you an invitation to commit your own personal energy to work against the force of racism in our society and press to build a new vision of human community. So we really are interested in something like a pledge, something like a personal commitment, regardless of where our conversations go as we work down toward the end. So this is our first series in this week coming on racism as a socio-spirit force in the life of America. Now let me pause for a moment, see if there are quick comments or questions, and then I want to take a look at this session and do a little bit more in-depth context before we get into the work of the evening. Any quick comments or questions? All right. Psalm 137. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, and there we wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows there we hung up our harps, for there our captors asked us for songs, and our tormentors asked us for mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How could we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither. Let my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you. If I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy, then to God. Remember, O Lord, against the Edomites the day of Jerusalem's fall, how they said, tear it down, down to its foundations. O daughter Babylon, you devastator, happy shall they be who pay you back what you have done to us. Happy shall they be who take your little ones and dash them against the rock. European Americans have cultural amnesia. We intentionally program it in. We have short memories. Are you familiar with the phrase, the Middle Passage? The Middle Passage is the name given to the route between Africa and the New World. The memory of the Middle Passage is alive. Only European Americans have historical amnesia. Native Americans remember. The Native Wakanton Dakota people in Minnesota every year hold a ceremony of commemoration in the city of Mankato, and they call out the names of the warriors who were hanged in 1863. At the end of the Dakota conflict. I bet you didn't remember that Psalm 137 was in our Bible, did you? It talks about memory, doesn't it? Memory is alive. European Americans have historical amnesia, and it is intentional that we have historical amnesia. And we want to explore some of the dimensions of that in the next few sessions with you. It is, we believe, of extreme urgency these days that we, you and I, as European Americans, talk about these matters in ways that we have not dared before. It is time for us to claim our heritage, and it is time for us to own who we are and to dare to have historical memory. And it is our belief that the future may depend upon that. Now, we hope to be able to maybe share with you something of a framework for reflecting upon the reality of racism in our day, in these Americas, and in particular in these United States. And yet, without a doubt, what is said here amongst us is not going to be the final word about racism. And we'll share some models with you, but there are many other models. And as many people have pointed out, racism is a complex, elusive, even ambiguous social reality. But it is a reality, it is not an abstraction. And therefore, if you have a different model for understanding the way racism works, that's tremendous. And there are many models around. We simply want to share with you some frameworks that we think maybe will be helpful to us. It is our intent that in these five sessions, we develop something like a kind of a journey motif, and a really kind of a spiraling journey, where each circuit of the journey would go a little deeper. And yet at the same time, we're aware that because of the way the programming is done in Houghton, each one of these sessions has to stand on its own, and so that is also our intent. Now, to begin to talk about racism, certainly I think it will not be an exhaustive exploration of the issue. And there are some temptations or traps that we think we need to be aware of in order to avoid. And the first one is guilt tripping. It may have been fashionable at one time in dealing with racism to indulge in guilt trips, either as one who was taking others on guilt trips or as one who was indulging in guilt trips. Guilt is a relatively objective reality, personally grounded, but an objective reality. And it is not our intent to head deep. Something else is required these days. But then the other side of the coin, there's a temptation that's one more common to liberals. And probably many of us in the room, if we were truthful, would own up to being good old liberals. And that is something like this. That, well, you know, really, under the skin, we're all the same. We're just human beings. Well, balderdash, to put it in acceptable language, we are not all the same. We have a 22-year-old son who's very dark, and he has spent 22 years of his life coming to terms with being a very dark African-American male in this society. And you do him an injustice to say to him, you and I are really the same. Under the skin, no, we are not the same. And that position trivializes the differences in the journey and the suffering and the cost that others have paid to forge their identity. And so that's a temptation that we want to avoid. Also, I think, is the temptation of cheap reconciliation, what Bonhoeffer might have called cheap grace. Well, now, that's all in the past. It happened 500 years ago, or slavery ended. Now, let's just get on with our lives and move into the future together. Well, European Americans are not going to set the agenda for the way this conversation fleshes itself out in this nation. We just will not do it, and we've got to understand that. We're going to be dictating the terms of reconciliation. And it is very true these days, I suspect, that how others feel about us is unimportant. And whether or not we're accepted by people of color is not the issue. The issue today is change and repentance. We got to get about the business of doing something new. And so there's a certain onus on us. Finally, I don't know if you've noticed, maybe it's slipped by you somehow, but we're an interracial couple. So we are not intending to suggest to you that the solution to the racial difficulties in our day lies in interracial relationships. It's hard enough these days to be married to anyone. And so we are not really suggesting that all of you ought to go out and rethink your marriage, or if you're not married, look for a covenantal relationship from another ethnic heritage. No. Now, if you know, that's a very personal decision that has to do with individual histories as well as family histories and communal histories. And I guess all we would want to say to you is we're not suggesting that's the way of the future, but rather you have a reality to deal with here, a historical reality, which is our covenantal relationship. Now, racism. Let's get into looking at a model, one that we found kind of intriguing, and one that at least has some echoes in a number of other individuals that have been doing some writing and thinking. On the one hand, we're very clear that prejudice is part of what we mean by racism, and that discrimination is part of what we mean by racism. Somebody give me a quick association with the word prejudice. What does that have to do with prejudice?
Prejudging.
Prejudging, yes. What else does it involve? Prejudice.
Feelings.
Feelings, certainly. Feelings and attitudes also involve stereotypes, doesn't it? Deep pictures. How about discrimination? What does that have to do with?
Action.
Yes, yes indeed, action. It's prejudice and action, isn't it? Now, what's the missing term in the equation? If personal prejudice is to be translated into communal action, what's the missing or third term that's necessary?
Power.
Power, exactly. Power. And in that society, this society, that's where you and I come in. Now, we've talked about, we've suggested racism as a socio-spirit force. Well, this takes care of the socio side of the equation. Prejudice, discrimination, and power. And certainly, prejudice is personal and individual, but it is also communal. The stereotypes that we have of a variety of people are communal. And they are reinforced by social acts of discrimination. It's really interesting, the dynamic between these two. You can't really clearly say that prejudice issues in discrimination. That certainly is true, but discrimination also creates prejudice in young minds that have not really been exposed to stereotypes. Seeing discrimination happening in society creates prejudicial attitudes. Now, what's the other side of the coin? Or if you like, what's the mirror image? We've called this the spirit dimension of racism because it is a mode of consciousness. It has to do literally with the fabric of consciousness. And it has to do in terms of prejudice with myth, story. And the mirror side of discrimination, this you'll find very interesting, is what you might call social liturgies, or litanies, or rituals. Let me give you an illustration of a social ritual that dramatizes a myth about racial identity that is even done unconsciously and without any reflection. Do you remember during the World Series when the Atlanta Braves came to Minneapolis to play the Minnesota Twins? What was it that upset the Native American people?
The
Tomahawk chop.
Now, if somebody was to say to most of those folks, that is a racist action, they deny that to the blue in the face. And certainly can't be described as discriminatory or discrimination. What we're suggesting to you is that it is a social liturgy that rehearses a myth of racial superiority. Now, the mirror side of power, then, would be symbols, or the symbolic. It has to do with icons and images. In session number 4 particularly, we want to look at mythology and how mythology operates and how the myth of racial identity has been one of the key mythologies in the development of American civilization. So we want to suggest this to you as one way of modeling or looking at the dynamics of racism in society as a socio-spirit force. And we want to use these next 4 sessions and this evening to flesh that out, put some flesh and blood on it for you, and see where it resonates with your experience, rings bells, and so on. Comments or questions on this?
Is this something you've developed on your own?
Oh, I think that it's been developed in conversation with a number of people. I think a lot of folks now are very clear about the dynamic of prejudice, discrimination, and power.
So we particularly put this image in shape together.
Other comments or questions? Can you think of any other social liturgies like the tomahawk chop that would be racist in the sense that they rehearse a racist consciousness that is based upon a myth of racial superiority and that trivializes others?
Ethnic jokes.
Ethnic jokes. Very interesting. Yes, I imagine that's true.
Advertising, of course, this is along Native American, but I remember a hearing on the radio with an ad, and they talk in like Tonto, and they make funny, you know, like they take yesteryear and put it in today's context and trying to say that the drugstore is whatever. And I thought that was uncalled for.
Well, you know, it's very interesting the way advertisers, particularly advertisers, play around with images. And if you watch the commercials on television, some of them are kind of frightening in terms of the imaginal impact. I've noticed lately that that one cereal, Special K, and 2 lines of cosmetics, I can't recall their names right now, do commercials with the color white. Everything is white. Have you know who described the Special K model to me? Don't you watch television? She's wearing a white bathing suit. Everything else is white. Well, watch for that. And look at that woman. Now, that seems to be innocuous, and it's very striking, very dramatic if you're an advertiser. You know, I'm sure that was really a creative breakthrough. But then when you start looking at mythology and the symbolic power of colors and begin to think about the associations that we have with colors, what color is purity?
White.
What color is goodness?
White.
What color are angels?
White.
What color is sin?
Black.
What color are you if you have a evil heart? What color is your heart?
Black.
Black-hearted
black
maid. Black.
You're black when you're 40.
And everything you want to avoid at all costs in terms of your reputation. What kind of mark?
Black.
Black sheep.
Colors are serious business, tremendous symbolic power.
We say we tell a white lie.
Yeah, we tell a white lie.
Yes, a little white, that's not a serious one.
Not so bad.
As opposed to a real one. Yes, indeed. Yes?
I noticed that when you really want to get people worked up, you say white slavery. And when you say white slavery, people think of young women being, young white women being taken somewhere. It's like slavery is slavery, but white slavery for some reason really gets hot.
Yes, indeed. Can you think of any other illustrations of any of these?
Use of the Dixie flag in the South, the Southern schools. And the insistence on some of the school, of some of the kids to raise Dixie.
Okay, and certainly there are a lot of associations with the stars and bars that are clearly racist. Okay, well, we want to go in a little bit different direction now, and I think the time has come. Are you ready?
Our group is doing a date for this exercise.
Yes.
This spring. Tonight we want to focus on the dynamics of racism, but look at the issue of institutionalized racism and how this whole dynamic plays right into the institutions. So for this exercise, I'm going to ask you to do two things. One is to be a risk taker tonight, and secondly, to kind of monitor your responses, because this is a difficult issue, yet when we confront it, we find that there is a healing power in the midst of it, if we get a chance to have a forum to begin to get inside of what it is that we're trying to deal with. Now, none of you became this way without having learned something and acquired. And that's true for everybody. From day one, you acquired everything you are today. You learned it. It's taught. It drummed into your imagination, etc. And I discovered, listening to someone this morning, that those same kinds of learned behaviors and poetry and words and colors still exist, because somebody said, maybe we should have had blue aprons for the men and pink aprons for the women. Well, there you are, you know, blue and pink was for boys and girls, right? That's kind of the way we were socialized, and all the things that we were educated with, that girls did this and boys did this. Well, we have a society full of people that on a certain, in a certain way, I mean, that you were given certain kinds of privileges and others weren't. And therefore, this is the manifestation of institutionalized racism, because there's some haves and some have not. So what I'm going to ask you to do tonight is to participate in an exercise where you read out loud what I will give you, and then a few of you will not be involved in that, and then we're going to talk about that. So what I'd like to see if we could do is just start right here, and you just take the first one and pass these slips around as far as they go. No, just take them. Aha! That's a clue. Don't get to choose. And I'm in charge up here. You notice that? Okay. Let's pass those around until we get to the very end. And it looks like, I guess we could pull in a little bit.
You know, what we could do is the ones who didn't get one could just come and sit in the middle.
Yeah, and listen.
Yeah.
That's what usually happens.
That's the first time around we could exclude everyone sitting on the floor, right?
That's what's going to happen.
No, okay.
Everybody that's sitting in the chair will get one of those slips as far as they can go.
Right.
That's the first thing. And then when I tell you the next step in the risk-taking part, I'm going to ask you just to be aware of your personal response as you begin to read these out loud. Because that's the next thing. This is not a test about your ability to read. This is just to see their reaction. Have they made it yet? They're coming.
You still got
a few more coming. At the end of our session this week, too, we will have references and resources and bibliographies, that kind of information, available for further study, because we have used a wealth of resources to pull together the brief exercises that you'll be doing in these five sessions together. Also, we are really excited about this. You're coming to the end.
Oh, I have to put my mini.
Okay, so the ones that, we're going to have people come in the center, we do not have them. All of you kind of come in to inside the circle who do not have a slip.
Well, we're going to have a couple of guys in here.
That's all right. Go around. She gets two. Come on. In the... Except for two people, Margaret and Verla do not come in.
Oh. You're with the script writer again.
Can you get everybody else?
There's some people in the far back.
In the far, far back. The lounge area.
Yes.
Okay. And you can come around the front.
We can all smoke together.
Yes. Did it make it around? Are we in? Who has number 44?
Okay.
She does.
All right. Now, all of you, including Margaret and Verlin, who do not have a slip, just listen carefully to what you will hear. And all of you who are reading, just note where you find yourself saying, aha, or, darn, that makes me angry, or, I didn't know this was going on. Is this really? All those reactions are important, and I'll tell you why when we finish this little exercise. So I'm going to start here with number one, and just read the first one only.
I can arrange to be in the company of people of my race most of the time.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear it.
I can arrange to be in the company of people of my race most of the time.
Next, please.
I can avoid spending time with people whom I was trained to mistrust and who have learned to mistrust my kind or me.
If I should need to move, I can be pretty sure of renting or purchasing a dwelling in an area which I can afford and in which I would want to live.
I can be pretty sure that my neighbors in such a location will be neutral or pleasant to me.
I can go shopping alone most of the time, pretty well assured that I will not be followed or harassed.
I can turn on the television or open to the front page of the paper and see people of my race widely represented.
When I am told about our national heritage or about civilization, I am shown that people of my color made it what it is.
I can be sure that my children will be given curricular materials that testify to the existence of their race.
If I want to, I can be pretty sure of finding a publisher for this piece on white privilege.
I can be pretty sure of having my voice heard in a group in which I am the only member of my race.
I can choose whether or not to hear another woman's voice in a group in which she is the only member of her race.
I can go into a music shop and count on finding the music of my race represented, into a supermarket and find the food I grew up with, into a hairdresser's shop and find someone who can deal with my hair.
Whether I use checks, credit card, or cash, I can count on my skin color not to work against the appearance of financial reliability.
I can do well in a challenging situation without being called a credit to my race.
I can arrange to protect my children most of the time from people who might not like them.
I do not have to educate my children to be aware of systematic racism for their own protection.
I can be pretty sure that my children will be well liked by their teachers. If they are obedient children, my chief worries about them do not concern societal attitudes towards their race.
I can swear or dress in secondhand clothes or not answer letters without having people attribute these choices to the bad morals, the poverty, or the illiteracy of my race. I can remain oblivious of the language and customs of persons of color who constitute the world's majority without feeling in my oblivion.
I am never asked to speak for all the people of my racial group.
I can talk with my mouth full and not have people put me down to my color.
If I have low credibility as a leader in a dominant society, I can be sure that my race is not the problem.
I can speak in public to a powerful male group without putting my race on trial.
I can be pretty sure that if I ask to talk to the person in charge, I will be facing a person of my race.
I can criticize our government and talk about how much I fear its policies and behavior without being seen as a cultural outsider.
If a traffic cop pulls me over, or if the IRS audits my tax returns, I can be sure I haven't been singled out because of my race.
I can easily buy posters, postcards, picture books, greeting cards, dolls, toys, and children's magazines featuring people of my race.
I can go home from most meetings of the organizations I belong to feeling somewhat tied in, rather than isolated, out of place, outnumbered, unheard, feared, or hated.
I can be pretty sure that an argument with a colleague of another race is more likely to jeopardize her chances for advancement than to jeopardize mine.
I can be pretty sure that if I argue for the promotion of a person of another race or a program centering on race, this is not likely to cost me heavily within my present setting, even if my colleagues disagree with me.
If I declare there is a racial issue at hand, or there isn't a racial issue at hand, my race will lend me more credibility for either position than a person of color will have.
I can choose to ignore developments in minority writing, minority activist programs, or disparage them, or learn from them, but in any case, I can find ways to be more or less protected from negative consequences of any of these choices.
My culture gives me little fear about ignoring the opinions of women and men who are not of my race.
I can take a job with an affirmative action employer without having my coworkers on the job suspect that I got it because of my race.
I am not made acutely aware that my shape, bearing, or body odor will be taken as a reflection of my race.
I can be pretty sure of finding people who would be willing to talk with me or advise me about my next steps professionally.
I can worry about racism without being seen as being self-serving.
I can think over many options, social, political, imaginative, or professional, without asking whether a person of my race would be accepted or allowed to do what I want to do.
I can expect to find in the grocery store staple foods which fit in with my cultural traditions.
I can be late to a meeting without having the lateness reflect on my race.
I can choose public accommodations without fearing that people of my race cannot get in or will be mistreated.
I can be sure that if I need legal or medical help, my race will not work against me.
I can arrange my activities so that I will never have to experience feelings of rejection owing to my race.
I can choose blemish cover or bandages and flesh color and have them more or less match my skin.
That was 44.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In our reflection conversation about what you just heard, I want to start with two people in this room, other than myself, who were listening to that, and get their reflections first. So Margaret or Verlin, what words or phrases struck you as you listened to those 44 statements?
guess choose kept coming up. I can choose to do this, or I can choose to do that, you know. And I guess, as an African American, a lot of stuff I don't choose. I feel like I'm oftentimes having to react to what's there, or take what's there, and make the best of it.
Well, it kind of made me feel like where I am now, out on the outer edge of what you have as choices, and I'm on the outer edge of that.
I kept thinking of, places that I've lived. Almost everything that was mentioned, I could think of an incident that has happened.
And it is reality.
Like, this is the way it is.
And you have to kind of do it if you want to succeed or get ahead or reach your goals. You have to put yourself in those uncomfortable situations and, you know, you don't really have a choice. I'm glad I go back to what I said before.
For the people in the circle, what words, phrases, comments struck you out of those 44 statements?
I can be sure of it. I think in generally, exclusion, how we exclude people of color in the social part of our lives, in the even in the corporate part, or even going to the store, how everything is kind of around excluding people of color, not bringing them in with us, just like the circle.
Well, Band-Aids, I never
can make it.
Yeah. The what? Band-Aids, you know,
you
things.
Makeup.
Yeah, that you just don't think about would exclude somebody else.
Yeah, Crayola's recently changed their name for the flesh-colored crayon. I don't know what they call it, but they don't call it flesh-colored anymore for that reason. Yeah,
and they actually have clear Band-Aids now. I just noticed.
Think about other changes.
I think the thing that gets me a lot is that we're doing this to our kids. And when you talk about toys and kids' magazines and kids' books that don't portray black children in the same light, or as much, you know, and if it is, like if you talk about a kid's reading book at school or a textbook at school, usually it's in some sort of token. They're very white-looking African-American. You know, they happen to be colored in black. And I think that's still happening, even though we're trying to make it better. But that really bothers me. And the fact that you can't get somebody who understands that the hair is a big deal. My oldest son is black. And I vividly remember him as a baby. You couldn't find anybody who could do anything with that hair.
Mm-hmm. Okay, those of you who read, where did you find yourself responding privately?
I had a feeling about, the first one I read was about being well assured I won't be followed or harassed, and I thought about fear, you know, being fearful of going places and doing things and always having to be on guard and things like that.
Okay.
So many times that I was representing my race was brought up in so many of these, and that really hit me because I never think that I'm representing a race, you know, and those statements really hit me.
I've lived for a long time abroad, and I felt that some of the statements are how I feel as an American in another person's country. And it caused me to think of my children who are Ethiopians and how they will feel in this country, that they won't be at home for other people of color, that it's like, for them it's like living abroad. Or in someone else's country, that's how I
Other reactions, go ahead. Questions?
What, actually, many things struck me, but what was overwhelming for me was how ordinary this is. How these things are just ordinary, everyday things that happen constantly.
For both groups? For yourself and for people about.
I found myself looking for ones that wouldn't be true for me.
Oh, okay.
And there weren't many. But they were all such commonplace parts of life that we did.
I had that feeling too, that there are a lot of things that were very interesting to me because there was, I mean, there was obviously a specific racial theme here. But as I was listening to a lot of them, I thought, oh, when I feel that way, I attribute it to something else. Like, I'm not tall, like, I'm a short woman. When I talk about getting credit or whatever, I'm not a powerful person. I'm short, I'm not a powerful person, and I'm female. And thinking, oh, that's, you know, I attributed all those feelings to other things. And as a minority person, we would probably have a tendency to look at that first to attribute it to it.
Evans?
I felt mainly real sad and felt a lot of shame around it. The thing that gets me is the worry and the self-conscious, you know, because I've dealt with worry and self-anxiety, just being in my own skin. This is really, you know, not of my own choosing this kind of thing.
Some of you have mentioned this, but what does this exercise really represent? What?
It's about privilege.
Privilege? Mm-hmm. Who's privilege?
The male, white male.
What? And you think female too, somebody says over here.
I would say our whole society.
Our whole society. At least certain ones in our whole society, for sure.
Okay.
And go ahead.
I was just going to say that, and I hope I'm not stepping on your toes here, but this was an article in a magazine, and it was written by a white woman who started out to write an article about sexism, and then she ended up, in a sense, sort of counting her blessings and kind of understanding that being a white female, she had privileges that people of color didn't have. So that might
be. Oh, yes, you're referring to the resource we're using for this. Yes.
Yeah.
That was what she was doing. That's right. Yeah. Others, you have other examples? Or go ahead.
Well, mine said, I can be sure that my children will be given curriculum materials that testify to the existence of their race. Mm-hmm. Well, I can't because my children are Mosquito Indians. And so that really, you know, that spoke to me. And I think that when you have children, when you have an interracial relationship, and when you have children that are interracial children, there are lots of things that they can't have that other people have. And there are things that I can't have that other people have because I've made that choice.
How do you see this functioning in our institutions, in our society?
It's in schools all over the place.
It's in schools all over the place.
It's not leaving opportunities for people of different races, you know, not giving opportunities to have privileges.
I keep thinking that for the people that say, well, I'm not prejudiced or I'm not very much prejudiced, they don't have to feel that way. They can probably document that in their own life, but when it comes to the voting booth, they can have somebody else do it. So a lot of times the power of the vote does it for us. I think of that as an institution.
And our procedures of voting. and our privilege to vote.
Okay, or I wouldn't mind having
black family moved next door to me, but I'm trusting that the realtor is going to screen the people who are, who they're showing the house to.
The practices of those things, the cops.
These all seem to be written from the white Caucasian standpoint. I mean, we could maybe fit into that, whereas a person of color could not fit in. It seemed like most of them were just representing maybe the white Caucasian who feels that he is the, or he or she is the dominant person. And that's the way it...
That's the way it comes to you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That it's all...
Most of them were geared in that respect, whereas you, for example, it wouldn't fit yourself or another person of color.
Oh, you're right. That's the point. It's here in the statement. Exactly. Any other examples?
Or the church.
Did he say the church? This is being
taped. Well, I think of the worship service last night. How many of our churches have a service like that once in a while, at least once in a while? The music, the liturgy, it's just not very inviting, I wouldn't think, to someone of another background of any sort.
That's because most organists only know Bach.
Well, we've got a little tiny baby who saw our first black person yesterday, mm-hmm. and just stared at him. Mm-hmm. And it dawned on me that she'd never seen a black person. We've been all over the world, and it just kind of, that's life, and this is the world. But for her, it was, I've got to look, and I want to touch. And we live in such a small community, maybe 1,000 people, and there are no people of color, any color, unless you go down to the docks. And you get to be on board a ship or something. So how do you educate your children and even the people that you live with that it's not always okay to be white and elitist, as we've read these statements?
Well, that's part of our, that's part of the reason why we're having this seminar. Bring something out.
That's number four.
But you have a very good point. You have a brand new mind.
Yeah, and I don't want to get
untouched.
Yeah.
And see, everything that happens to her is going to be taught and learned by somebody, something.
Yeah.
So, actually, it's a challenge to all of us to both address what you're saying. You've been around the world, you've had some experiences. Now, how are you going to deal with that from the history you have had, mm-hmm. of your own past, as well as your experiences of living around the world? And then not to have her grow up in such a way that
she believes all that
and then repeats exactly what we're trying to deal with here, this kind of superiority attitude and the privileges, et cetera, et cetera. So we have a challenge before us to begin to educate in a new way and use new language and figure out new images, et cetera.
Is there another country or another culture that you're familiar with that maybe has done a better job than America has? It wasn't in Saul.
No, not that I'm aware of, because I feel that this particular time we're faced with forms of racism across the world. I mean, you can look anywhere. Your question is more of what they're doing about it or trying to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Another.
I'm not better.
Better, yeah. Is there another country or culture that has done it better?
I'm not aware of one. There are probably people trying to deal with it, because, and that's what some of the uprisings are about, is they're trying to have their humanity and dignity and everything back. But racism is running rampant, as we know, about a specific country in this world that's working on it. Does anybody else?
Well, I've got an anecdote about Nigeria, because we lived there for a couple of years and we bought some Band-Aids one time. We got a bullet put on our kids and they were real black, and we thought, well, maybe these are kind of like stars and stripes band-aids you can get at home. Then a couple days later, it dawned on us, oh, these are flesh-toned band-aids. And we just didn't realize it.
That's tremendous.
I imagine there are several efforts on a small scale that we just don't get a chance to hear about, because there are efforts around trying to
live in the past. Other regions.
I can't answer the question on the better part. I just know that people have tried.
You know, I think there, there may be some, I think there's some interesting efforts happening in some of the Latin American nations that maybe have some clues in them. But I don't, like you, I don't know if anybody that we could say is doing a better job.
Like we said earlier, it's complex, as you, and some of your comments are pointing out the complexity, because some of these things we're doing so normally, and they're everyday issues for other people. And how are you going to deal with organized power, in a sense, which is what we've discovered as some of our examples of institutions are so organized, and they're not even, some of them are not even aware of it and may be oblivious to it and don't want to try and deal with it. So we've got a challenge and a huge job for us, especially in the area of education too.
It seems like we feed into it. We seem to feed into it because, like, our biggest communication source being television, and you know, anytime you see a black person in television, there's like a point to make it that person's black for some reason.
That's right.
I mean, that it's about them being black, that they're, you know, that's what makes us in need or something. So it's like it just feeds into it over and over.
We're going to come to a summation pretty soon, but the media is very powerful. Mm-hmm. And you can tell when the change has been made in our society. The numbers of people of color who have come forth now, we're really into the big swing now. I mean, they're gone, great guns on them. I mean, you look at the TV and you can see a lot of African American and European American. We have yet to raise up the Native Americans. We have some Asians. But you watch the media, you watch the progression of how that works. Then you gotta look at the messages that they're sending out. And whose value system is that based on, et cetera, et cetera. Who's determining who gets to the media? All of that.
And now back to this woman with the young mind. And,
the lady with the young mind.
You know, I'm not going to say this right. One thing I would do is to, I know what, there's this generic man and humankind and all that, but there, in fact, that's a myth too. And I mean, like when I talk this, you can start to, you know, if something is created by white culture, call it, well, that's white culture. You know, don't just assume that you talk about humans that they're white, and to distinguish it. And the way I, several ways that processes in my life and as a woman is when I talk about seeing the world issues and blah, 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 and these decisions being made that are killing people or doing whatever. I mean, I always have to switch. Who is making this decision? Are women making these decisions? No. These decisions are made by men. And it pulls me out, and it somehow empowers me that I'm not part of that, but that I can counter that in some way. Likewise, I know for some people they will rally against labeling, that you don't need to label everything, but yet that's the only way to, that's one way, it's not the only way, to start making it visible.
So one of our sessions, and may I make another announcement here, is going to deal with where in the world did all this come from, this race categorizing, and getting, trying to get to the roots of this race category, period, and see how we got into this situation. And then we could even look at how, in the past, some people have tried to overcome this whole issue of race from a historical perspective, too. That's going to be another exciting topic, so come back.
We are almost out of time, and let me say that we're not going to run off when 7:45 comes, but I know that the Vespers happen sooner, so we're going to wind it up in just a few minutes.
want to say just a couple of things in closing. First, how many of you in the inner circle or sitting around here would say that you have not experienced white privilege? Okay, so that none of the statements that you read really, you heard read.
Well, no, what I'm thinking, I probably have interpreted it wrong.
Okay.
My story is I went to Englewood to visit my son, and he lived in a black community. So he needed groceries, and I didn't think anything about it, so I went to the grocery store. Well, I was the only white person in that store.
Uh-huh.
And boy, they just all looked down at me and gave me dirty looks when I went to buy groceries. And I thought, I'm just buying groceries and paying for them. What am I doing wrong?
Yeah.
And that really hit me.
Yeah, I can resonate with that. And isn't that experience really, for the first time, created the awareness of a privilege
really
that you'd come to assume.
To think, well, I couldn't go get groceries.
Right. Are there any of you in the circle that consider yourselves persons of color? In the same way that Nadine is?
No.
All right. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Well, it's really interesting. Occasionally, somebody who, well, not to the eye, seemed to be an African American or a Native American will say, yes, I'm an African American, or I'm a Native American, which underscores one of the irrationalities in the way in which we've thought about race. It's been based on skin color. And yet, if you look at the people down through the decades of our history who've been categorized, for example, African American, many of them could sit in this inner circle and not be recognized as a person of color. And then the year 2000, one out of five new people entering our workforce will be white males. One out of five. The rest will be persons of color and women. In the United States. One out of five entering our workforce in the United States. Now, the statistics probably in Canada would be a little different, but basically the same realities are going on there. Probably the balances would be there.
I was just having some thought about this. I live in Winnipeg, and although there's a real multi-ethnic makeup of the city, the whole thing in Canada is French and English, you know, everything like that. And that has, it's not color, but it still has these same tones, you know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
And within Winnipeg, it has some reverberation, it's sort of highlighted with ethnic groups, the Jewish people, the Ukrainian people. The Jewish people, or the Ukrainian people within the wrong side of the track. And those are back to the ethnic joke type of thing.
Yes.
It still exists very much.
Yes, and you tend to have an invisible population like we do. That is your indigenous population, which is a sort of the invisible factor in the, that is overlooked in the chemistry of the current tension that's going on. Well, you know, it's interesting that racism holds us all in its grip. It is not a black problem. If it has to be anybody's problem, we ought to say that it's our problem. If it didn't get clear to you as we went around the circle and read those statements, we are racists. That's what it means to be able to depend upon white privilege unreflectively. That's what racism is about, and that's what institutionalized racism is about. It does not depend on individual prejudice. It is a social program that is self-perpetuating. And if we are to do anything about living in the grip of racism, we have to recognize its power, call it, name it for what it is, recognize our participation in it, and be about the business of visioning an alternative human community. Now, do you remember the name of the man who penned the words of Amazing Grace?
John Newton.
Yes, John Newton.
John Newton.
Yes. Do you know the story of John Newton?
Yep.
Some of us were here last week.
All right, so those of you who were here last week know that John Newton was a slaver. who had something rather powerful happen in his life and decided to do something else with his life. And after having made that decision, penned the words of Amazing Grace. Who can recite the words of the first verse of that?
Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that freed a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found.
Now, I have some colleagues who I respect a great deal who have real difficulty, particularly with that wretch line. You know, they think that it's an example of worm theology. But it seems to me that they miss really what the song's about. It's confessional theology. It's confessional theologizing. He was telling them the way it is in terms of his experience of himself. It's really an incredible song. You want to sing?
Yes. Listen. Amazing.